It's Tuesday, March 30th. The video shocked the world, and it still shocked a jury 10 months later. We start here. The Derek Chauvin trial begins where George Floyd's life ended.
Some said that they simply couldn't stomach watching the whole thing.
But there was stuff here we've never seen before. We're going to walk you through day one. Everyone's becoming eligible.
90% of adults, people over 18 and over.
But is everyone becoming safer? Why, the CDC director says she's still scared of COVID deaths. And these voting rights bills are new unless you feel like you've lived through them before.
Many are worried that this could actually be a new Jim Crow.
Why entire towns in the Deep South say they see history repeating itself. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Putting a trial live on national TV is rare, but it certainly happened before.
Here is the judge, Ito, in this courtroom.
All right, back on the record in the Simpson matter. Mr. Simpson is again present before the court with his counsel, Mr. Shapiro, Mr. Carthron, Mr. Kardashian, Mr. Bailey, Mr. Blazer.
The O.J. Simpson trial in the 90s became this kind of cultural frenzy. Move over soap operas, because this outrated anything else you could put on the air.
And if you look at O.J. Simpson over there, and he has a rather large head, O.J. Simpson, in a knit cap from two blocks away, is still O.J. Simpson.
And there is a case to be made that that actually encouraged lawyers to play to the public as much as the jurors, that to some, it undermined faith in the legal system. The trial of Officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis is certainly big. It's divisive. It means a lot of things to lots of people. But there are some key differences here. One, because of COVID, you can't just watch this play out in person, even if you lined up at the courthouse early. Two, the main piece of evidence here has already been watched by most of the country. And three, perhaps most importantly, to many, this case is fundamentally about whether the justice system can be trusted. For millions of Americans, this doesn't feel like that many steps beyond what they have experienced personally. So while Minnesota had never before broadcast a trial, activists close to this case were pleading, people deserve to see this. They must see this.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Members of the jury, before we begin the trial, we'll administer an oath to you.
And so yesterday morning, one judge, 12 jurors, and two alternates sat in front of a handful of lawyers with cameras rolling as Derek Chauvin faced trial for the murder of George Floyd. Let's go to ABC's Whitney Lloyd, who's been covering this day by day. Whitney, how did this play out in day one?
Hey, Brad. Yeah, so yesterday we saw opening statements in the Derek Chauvin trial, and right away the state got right to it and played that now infamous Facebook video taken by a bystander that shows Chauvin and the other officers kneeling on Floyd's neck and ultimately him passing away.
So with that, I'm going to show you the video evidence. The video evidence, I think, will be very helpful and meaningful to you because you can see it for yourself without lawyer talk, lawyer spin, lawyer anything. You can see it for yourself.
So, you know, I want to warn your listeners, we're going to play a part of the video like they did in court yesterday. It is very disturbing, so we don't really like to play it when we don't have to, but it is what the jury heard. So I think it's worth listening to a little bit of it here to remember exactly what it was that they heard in court yesterday.
Look how they throwing people out here. He's got his feet on the ground.
You know, many of the jurors during jury selection had said that they had only seen clips of the video. Some said that they simply couldn't stomach watching the whole thing. But yesterday in court, they really had no choice but to sit there. You know, we see the officers kneeling on top of Floyd. We hear him repeatedly saying that he cannot breathe, that his stomach hurts, at one point crying for his mother. And just begging for his life, really. And that's what the jury heard yesterday in court.
9:29, the three most important numbers in the case, 9 minutes and 29 seconds, is how long that went on. For half of that time, Mr. Floyd was unconscious, breathless, pulseless.
You know, the prosecution made it clear that they don't see this trial as a repudiation of all police officers. But instead, they say it's really about the actions that Derek Chauvin took.
And this case is not about split-second decision-making. In 9 minutes and 29 seconds, there are 479 seconds, not a split second among them.
and all of the opportunities he had during that time period to make a different decision, to get off of Floyd's neck.
How did the defense respond? Because we talked with Alex Perez yesterday about how if it's the prosecution, it's rather simple. But if you're the defense, I mean, what do you even say back to that? What can you say back to that?
You know, the defense didn't even really reference that infamous video of Floyd's death in their opening statement.
Derek Chauvin did exactly what he had been trained to do over the course of his 19-year career. The use of force is not attractive, but it is a necessary component of policing.
For them, this case is really much more about Floyd's cause of death. And their point is that it wasn't just Chauvin's restraint of Floyd, in their view, that killed him. Instead, they say
the autopsy revealed many other issues, including coronary disease, an enlarged heart.
That Floyd had underlying medical conditions, drug addiction, and untreated heart issues that they think are what caused his death, more so than the restraint that Chauvin and the other officers used last Memorial Day.
You will see and hear that a crowd begins to develop, watching and recording officers, initially fairly passive. As the situation went on, the crowd began to grow angry.
They also said yesterday in their opening statements that Chauvin and the others were distracted from their duty as officers of caring for Floyd.
There are people behind them. There are people across the street. There are cars stopping, people yelling.
By what defense attorney Eric Nelson called a growing crowd of bystanders that he said Chauvin and the other officers viewed as a threat to their safety.
Wait. So there's a crowd of people yelling at these police officers, "Hey, you're killing this guy. You're killing this guy." And the defense is now saying, well, look what you made them do. Like, this guy died because you were yelling at them.
To some extent, yeah. You know, they said that their training is to sort of be on guard for threats that might cause issues for them while they're out on the streets patrolling. And that this crowd of bystanders was perceived as a threat by Chauvin and the other officers.
Okay, and so those opening statements, I mean, they were done relatively quickly enough, so much so that the prosecution actually got to go to its first witnesses, right?
That's right. We heard from three witnesses yesterday. The first witness was a 911 dispatcher that actually sent the officers to the scene when the employees from Cup Foods called to report Floyd using a counterfeit $20 bill to buy cigarettes.
Now the officers have opened a rear passenger door. Do you remember seeing this part of the video?
Yes. I remember seeing the squad move.
And interestingly, the 911 dispatcher said she actually watched the incident unfold on a city surveillance camera that was mounted across the street.
How did it appear at that time when you went back to it?
It had not changed.
And what do you mean by that?
They were still on the ground. The whole situation was still on the scene.
And that video was video we had never seen before. And she said it wasn't very often that she would actually see the incident that she had dispatched officers to play out on camera. But she became so concerned.
There just something wasn't right. I don't know how to explain it. It was a gut instinct.
That she actually called a police sergeant to report what she was seeing and her concern. And they actually played a little bit of that phone call in court.
I don't know if they had used force or not. They got something out of the back of the squad, and all of them sat on this man. So I don't know if they needed you or not, but they haven't said anything to me yet.
Yeah, they haven't said anything. This is just a takedown, which doesn't count, but
okay,
I'll find out.
And again, you not being a Minneapolis police officer are not familiar with the use of force requirements, correct?
You are correct.
All right.
The defense tried to sort of poke holes in the 911 dispatcher's account, saying that, you know, she's not trained in Minneapolis police tactics or use of force.
I mean, you were still watching your rest of your work, right?
Correct. I was actively still working.
So you're look up for a couple seconds, look down, do your work, look up, look down from time to time throughout the course of this incident.
You're correct.
All right.
So they tried to make the point that she was not an expert.
Your Honor, the state would call Donald Williams to the stand.
And then the last witness of the day was a gentleman by the name of Donald Williams. He was a bystander that you can hear in the background of that now infamous Facebook video, repeatedly telling the officers to get off of Floyd's neck. Mm-hmm. And he really becomes the most vocal person on the scene.
First, you go into a basic class. They teach you the basic techniques of jiu-jitsu. How to be able to defend yourself on the back.
He's actually a wrestler and trained in mixed martial arts, and that was something the defense was very concerned about in pretrial motions, because they were concerned that he might use that experience and training and have something to say about the way that the officers restrained Floyd.
Like I said, when I first arrived on the scene, Mr. Floyd was vocalizing his sorriness and his pain and his the stress that he was going through.
And he was very powerful on the stand. He described watching Floyd fade away.
Slowly fade away, and like the fish in the bag, you've seen his eyes slowly, you know, pale out and again slowly roll to the back of his eyes.
So, you know, he did speak about his martial arts training and his belief that he thought that Chauvin had Floyd in what's called a blood choke.
And did you say that to the officer?
That's correct.
And how did he respond when you said that to him?
He looked at me right here. It's the only time he looked at me. When I said it was a blood choke, it's the only time he looked up. We looked each other dead in our eyes. Yeah, and when I said it, he acknowledged it.
And court actually ended a few minutes early yesterday due to technical difficulties with the live stream. Judge Cahill is very aware of the need to make sure the public has access to this trial. So he elected to end things a few minutes early to sort out those issues, which means that Donald Williams will actually be back on the stand later today.
Yeah, which goes to show you just how important sort of letting people see this unfold in real time is to this judge and to this city. All right, Whitney Lloyd, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, it's not a great sign when the CDC director starts using words like impending doom, the next foreboding chapter of COVID-19, after the break.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face-Off launches April 9th.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So, let me start here. First,
we already know that by May 1st, every American is supposed to be eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine. Well, yesterday at the White House, President Biden said that doesn't even do justice to how quickly this is all moving.
So we're moving toward 90-90 by April 19th. That is, by April 19th, 3 weeks from today, 90% of adults, people over 18 and over, will be eligible to get vaccinated. 90% of all Americans will be living within 5 miles of a place they can get a shot.
And in fact, yesterday, multiple states backed him up on this claim that eligibility is expanding rapidly.
More categories opened up today, meaning more people can make appointments here.
Take New Hampshire. Yesterday, anyone 40 years old or over was suddenly eligible to get their shot. Well, this Wednesday, tomorrow, the age drops to 30. That means someone who's 42 years old literally has 2 days to sign up for a vaccine appointment before another huge chunk of the population joins them in line. It's not done then, because on Friday, it opens up to everyone 16 years or over in New Hampshire.
So today's news is we will be starting vaccines for the general public. Anybody can access the life-saving, highly effective, safe vaccine starting this Friday, April 2nd, in Colorado.
Colorado made a similar announcement. So did New York, which is why this morning at 8 a.m., tons of New Yorkers who are over the age of 30 are going to be sitting anxiously in front of their computers trying to get a slot. So go to ABC Stephanie Ebb. Stephanie, can I just ask, why are states opening it up so fast? Because in Colorado, 50 to 60-year-olds became eligible a week ago. This Friday, every adult becomes eligible. There's just not enough time for every 50-something-year-old to get their shot.
Right. You know, we don't have enough doses. There's not enough appointments for everyone in those categories to sign up on that first day. A lot of this is because of that May 1st deadline that Biden imposed. States are trying to scale up to that.
On April 15th, everybody in the state of California 16 and over can get a vaccine.
So on the surface, you know, you could say it's a good thing, right? We're moving through the process. More people are becoming eligible. They can get vaccinated. That's great. The flip side of that, right, is if you go back to one of the last vaccine-related announcements from the Trump administration, they said, we want to make eligibility, 65 and up, people with medical conditions, things like that. That raised a lot of concerns about the equity of this process.
I know of plenty of people that got it that shouldn't have or didn't need to get it so quickly. And I'm a good example of somebody that was shoved back.
This shift toward more of an age-based priority system has raised a lot of concerns that it will take resources away from those communities that are more vulnerable. Some of that comes down to how the states and jurisdictions are doing things.
Well, so if a state is opening it up from 40 to all of a sudden 16, that's the jump. Is that a state essentially throwing up its arms and saying, it's just too cumbersome, just come get it, everyone. We're done with this, distinguishing between groups. Or is it them saying, if we open it up to this specific age range, we don't actually know that many people are going to come get it. So we might as well open it up to the age range below that as well.
I think that's the bigger concern. And we don't have enough data yet to know that for sure. But the concern that we've been hearing from the public health professionals and the doctors that we work with is that the reason states are able to move through these categories so quickly is that the people in the category that was eligible previously, they vaccinated all those people who were amped up to get in line, and then they realized they had more doses than demand. So they opened it up to more people.
Well, and that said, we got new statistics yesterday showing that I think it's over 70% of seniors in this country have at least started to get vaccinated. So that's a pretty healthy number among seniors. But yesterday, Stephanie, we really saw this kind of renewed sense of fear from the CDC as far as COVID transmission. What is happening with COVID cases right now?
So the number of cases is going up.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
And this is an interesting thing. I watch these White House COVID briefings regularly. My team covers them every time. We see these warnings pretty consistently.
We are at that very precarious position that we were right before the fall surge.
Dr. Walensky from the CDC and Dr. Fauci, they've been very concerned that the baseline number of cases in the country was still too high. What we saw yesterday is really that they seem extremely concerned.
I'm going to pause here. I'm going to lose the script, and I'm going to reflect on the recurring feeling I have of impending doom. We have so much to look forward to, so much promise and potential of where we are, and so much reason for hope. But right now, I'm scared.
We heard Dr. Walensky very emotionally talk about how scared she is. She said she feels a sense of impending doom about a potential another surge and rise in cases.
I know that feeling of nausea when you read the crisis standards of care and you wonder whether there are going to be enough ventilators to go around and who's going to make that choice.
Bringing her back to her time treating COVID patients in Massachusetts and how difficult she said that was.
So I'm speaking today not necessarily as your CDC director, and not only as your CDC director, but as a wife, as a mother, as a daughter, to ask you to just please hold on a little while longer.
And then only hours later, we heard President Biden appealing to governors.
Please, this is not politics. Reinstate the mandate if you let it down.
Saying, please reinstate your mask mandates. Please stop reopening.
Now's not the time to celebrate.
So, you know, the administration as a whole are really pleading with the country, both on a state level and as individuals, to like, please continue to take this virus seriously, because they are frightened of the consequences if we don't.
Right. Just because more people are eligible for a vaccine does not mean everyone's suddenly safer. Like having the right to click into a web portal does not mean we've reached any kind of herd immunity. All right, Stephanie Ebbs, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
For decades, there's been a pattern in this country. Every 4 years, as the election gets closer, people say, you know what, some of these rules on voting and registration and ballot counting, they're insane. Like, we should do something about that. And people agree and disagree, and everyone says this should really be a priority when the new president takes over. But then someone gets elected. That becomes our new reality. And suddenly, laws about gerrymandering and voting rights seem a little bit more distant. At least, that's how it used to be. But this past weekend, you saw election year level arguments happening over the passage of a new set of voting laws in Georgia.
We quickly began working with the House and Senate on further reforms to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. The bill I signed into law does just that.
Those popular outdoor ballot drop boxes that were available 24/7 can now only be used inside an early voting location and only while that location is open. You'll now need to provide a license or an ID number to vote by mail. And it's now a crime in Georgia for anyone other than a poll worker to offer food or water to people waiting in the endless lines they often see in the large cities.
What I'm worried about is how un-American this whole initiative is. It's sick. It's sick.
And there are other similar sets of rules being taken up and passed around the country. Democratic activists like Stacey Abrams have said in many ways, this is the single most important issue the country can face right now. Some Republicans have said this could define whether the Republican Party can even survive. And throughout the South, there are communities who see this as a tipping point moment for civil rights in this country, because in some ways, these communities have lived through a similar moment before. Let's go to ABC's Brianna Stewart. She's been working with our colleagues at Soul of a Nation, ABC's acclaimed primetime show examining the Black experience in America. And Brianna, your reporting actually took you back in time in a way.
Yes, Brad, there are communities around this country, particularly in the South, that have been dealing with this issue for more than 150 years.
If I take the rural route along the bayou and the river, there's plantations still everywhere. It's a pain that I've learned to live with.
We spoke to descendants in Donaldsonville, Louisiana, which is a historic town that really created a name for itself during Reconstruction.
This was a community where Black people lived, where they thrived.
A thriving community here, not only after emancipation, but even before the Civil War. There were free people of color who lived in this corridor.
During the peak of Reconstruction in the late 1860s, early 1870s, there were freedmen towns. These were areas where formerly enslaved African Americans really established themselves.
We know about all of the Black doctors, and we had inventors, teachers.
Investing in schools, businesses, becoming state legislators. In the town of Donaldsonville, this is actually where the country sees its first Black mayor.
For the Black men who had just gained the right to vote after emancipation, coming back from the Civil War, I think it was a very exciting time and a hopeful time for African Americans, that they were going to be on the rise and finally be able to enjoy their freedom.
Enthusiasm and hope. But then what happened?
Terror. Toward the end of Reconstruction, we started to see groups like the Knights of the White Camellia and the Ku Klux Klan.
people really thrived until there was this violent backlash.
This is the first time that you start to see people being intimidated, lynchings, beatings.
Angry white Southerners who really took issue with the rise of Black political power at the time.
There started to be accusations of malfeasance in office. These men were constantly under attack.
Eventually, it became difficult for African American men to hold these seats in elected office because of the continuous attacks. And without the government really intervening, it was impossible to sort of crack down on the domestic terrorism that was really happening at the local level in these southern states.
Brianna, I feel like that could blow some minds, right? This idea that you did have towns after the Civil War in the Deep South that were really aspiring to be the model for what a multiracial, multicultural society could look like. And yet then there's this emotional, violent backlash to all that. And beyond even the violence, that leads to something more codified.
Right. So we see the way that violence really intimidated Black voters towards the end of Reconstruction. But once Jim Crow was introduced, when segregation became law throughout the South, that's when we really see voter disenfranchisement really play out in this Jim Crow era. Poll taxes were in place, literacy tests, all of these voter intimidation efforts were enabled, and therefore disenfranchised African Americans from being able to cast their ballot.
This is in the 1870s, a Black man became governor of the state of Louisiana. He was only governor for 6 weeks, though. And then comes in Reconstruction and Jim Crow laws, and America doesn't have a Black governor for another 100 years.
Take one step forward, five
10,000 steps back.
So when we talk to residents in Donaldsonville, Louisiana, you can see how decades of not having representation really affect their quality of life.
We rank number 45 in healthcare, number 48 in education, number 50 in environmental quality, number 50.
These are residents who are frustrated with having to live next to chemical plants. You have many residents who live in that area who are frustrated about the Confederate names and Confederate symbols that are surrounded all around them, even though these are majority Black towns. But because they don't have the proper advocacy and representation, little changes in the way that they want to see it.
Because there are people who just, they serve, but they don't care. When you think about the magnitude of what Black people have contributed to this country and that we've had so few opportunities to be in leadership.
We see the way that these policies have evolved over time. You know, Louisiana is one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. It's a state where over a third of the population is Black, and yet out of six representatives, there's only one Black representative in the state. And that's due to the district maps, which consolidate all of the Black Democratic voter support into one district, which is the second congressional district.
Well, and so if that's how this played out over 150 years, what about this year, Brianna? Like, you spoke to people in some of these towns. What did they say about this moment and whether this moment represents something new?
Y'all get up early and go vote.
I think it's fair to say after a year of racial reckoning where you saw the highest turnout of African Americans and minority voters across the board.
ABC News now projecting that Democrat Raphael Warnock will win his race. He has a several.
And Black Democratic voters in particular saw a win they haven't seen in 20 years.
The 82-year-old hands that used to pick somebody else's cotton went to the polls and picked her youngest son to be a United States senator.
Electing the first Black senator in Georgia. That was a win not just for Georgia, but for many Black Southerners who never thought that they would see a day like that come.
What we have witnessed today is a desperate attempt to lock out and squeeze the people out of their own democracy.
So all that momentum and victory is now challenged by the over 250 Republican-led bills to restrict voting rights across 43 states.
When voting in person in the state of Georgia, you must have a photo ID. It only makes sense for the same standard to apply to absentee ballots as well.
Analysts say these measures will clearly disenfranchise minority voters. And this moment really strikes a chord for Black voters, particularly in the South, who remember seeing their grandmother, great-grandmother, talk about the stories of trying to vote and being unable to. Many are worried that this could actually be a new Jim Crow.
Wow. So what's next for these towns in the meantime?
So when I talk to residents in Donaldsonville, like Kathy Hambrick, who is a historian and a preservationist who's rebuilding her town one building at a time.
We are encouraging people who know that their grandparents owned houses here to come back, reclaim this property, take pride in this community. It's not just about reconstructing America or this town through government and policy.
It's more than that.
It's about what we can do as individuals. I decided to do something.
She hopes for progress, but to her, it's going to be up to self-accountability, investing in her community and doing what she can at the local level until government sorts things out.
Yeah, it's interesting that your reporting has shown that as you're dealing with kind of this question of whether we're in a new Jim Crow, we're also seeing perhaps the reverse of the Great Migration, with a lot of people moving back to some of these neighborhoods, some of these communities. It's fascinating stuff. Breonna Stewart working with A Soul of a Nation. Tonight, there will be more stories about the act of voting itself and how some unlikely people have really emerged at the center of all these controversies. All right, Breonna, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brad.
And one last thing. This is the song I imagine was being played on board the MV Ever Given yesterday, as it was finally released from the shores of the Suez Canal. In reality, the scene sounded more like this. Let's just remember how truly colossal this problem was. A ship that is a quarter mile long was stuck diagonally across the Suez Canal, blocking hundreds of ships behind it. And you think, okay, use a towboat, drag it out of there. Well, its bow was resting on the shoreline, and this boat weighs 400 million pounds. To make matters worse, if you try to pull it straight out, engineers will tell you that actually creates more suction with the mud. So the answer became twofold: digging and pivoting.
Egyptian tugboats pulled and pushed from either side, working with specialist engineers from around the world who dredged some 30,000 cubic meters of sand from under the hull.
You've probably seen images of this tiny, lonely excavator machine shoveling away at the dirt below this monstrous ship. It's like Mike Mulligan's steam shovel was having a nightmare. Well, there was also a boat, a dredger, pumping up earth from under the water's surface while tugboats furiously pulled from side to side. We were getting close. There was just one more thing to do: wait for high tide. You might remember looking up a couple nights ago. It was a full moon. That was the highest the waterline was going to get this month. So when it wasn't working, authorities thought, oh no, like this might take weeks.
Container ships alone cost as much as $10 billion in global trade each day they sat idle on the water.
Well, eventually the water did rise back up, and this time the ship gently floated free, towering nearly 100 feet higher than the boats that rescued it. Now, it could still take weeks for the ships waiting in line to make their way through the canal, and now every captain will be holding their breaths, hoping they don't accidentally start to slip sideways. Excavator deserves to have its story told, right? Like, hold on to your movie rights, little excavator. Don't give them away for nothing. Hey, again, you can catch Soul of a Nation tonight at 10 Eastern on ABC. More on all these stories, including live coverage of the Chauvin trial, at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.